This is Ann Weller with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. During the next 30 minutes, I will be sharing nutrition information with you. This information is selected from the Nutrition Action Health Letter, a publication of the Center for Science in the Public Interest, based in Washington, D.C. The Center for Science in the Public Interest was founded in 1971 by three scientists who wanted to apply their academic training to the solving of social problems. It conducts innovative research and programs in health and nutrition, and it provides consumers with current information about their health and well-being. An independent, nonprofit consumer health group, the center promotes honest food labeling and advertising, safer and more nutritious foods, and pro-health alcohol policies. The work of the Center for Science in the Public Interest is supported by Nutrition Action Health Letter subscribers and by foundation grants. It accepts no government or industry funding, and Nutrition Action Health Letter, which was first published in 1974, accepts no advertising. The following edition of Nutrition News is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Please use the information presented in this broadcast in consultation with your personal physician. In the cover story of the June 2011 issue of Nutrition Action Health Letter, Director of Nutrition Bonnie Lieben discusses diabetes and how we can lower our risk of developing the disease. An estimated 11% of adults have diabetes, and a quarter of them don't even know it. But that doesn't tell the whole story. Experts estimate that by 2050, one out of three adults will have diabetes. Among people over 65, one out of four already has diabetes. And another 35% of all adults, and half of those over the age of 65, have a condition called prediabetes. But there is good news. Type 2 diabetes is almost entirely preventable. People who have a healthy weight and lifestyle have a 90% lower risk of diabetes, says Joanne Manson, professor of epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health. The beta cells in the pancreas produce insulin, which is a hormone that acts like a key to admit blood sugar into cells, where it can be stored or burned for fuel. If your fasting blood sugar is higher than 100, you have a condition called prediabetes. And if your fasting blood sugar is higher than 125, you have diabetes. It's easy to see why blood sugar soars in people who have type 1 diabetes, because in type 1 diabetes, the beta cells in their pancreas makes no insulin. People who have type 2 diabetes, which accounts for 90 to 95% of cases, often make plenty of insulin, but the insulin does not work well. Their cells are resistant to the insulin, so the body needs to pump more of it, explains Varman Samuel, assistant professor of medicine at the Yale School of Medicine. And for a while, the beta cells can compensate, so blood sugar levels stay under control. But in many people, the pancreas cannot keep up with the demand for insulin. And when the beta cells poop out, you tip over into diabetes, says Dr. Samuel. Insulin output falls short, and blood sugar climbs. It's as though you're listening to loud music, but you have wax in your ears, he suggests. So you keep turning up the volume, but you still can't hear because the music is not getting through. Then, at some point, your speakers blow. The question is, what sets off insulin resistance in the first place? It's hard to miss the first clue that explains insulin resistance. Roughly 80% of people with type 2 diabetes are overweight or obese. Surplus calories are turned into fat and stored in your subcutaneous and visceral fat cells. But when those cells fill up, the body stores fat in muscles and in the liver. And a fatty liver and visceral fat are most closely linked to insulin resistance and diabetes. Excess body weight is by far the strongest risk factor for diabetes, says Harvard's Dr. Joanne Manson, who heads the Division of Preventive Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. And the visceral fat deep in your belly may boost the risk of diabetes the most. If we could get people to a healthy weight, it could eliminate roughly half of all the cases of diabetes, says Dr. Manson. That's the big picture. Obesity does not explain why we all, no matter how fat or thin, have a greater risk of diabetes as we get older. And genes, smoking, exercise, and diet also play a role. But for most people, the trouble starts when they eat too many calories day after day. Any excess calories you eat are eventually turned into fat that needs to be stored, explains Kimber Stanhope, a molecular biologist at the University of California in Davis. At first, the fat fits into your fat cells. Let's say your body is doing a good job of being able to store the fat, says Dr. Stanhope. But once your fat cells get too large, they are less likely to continue to take up and retain more fat. And some obese people may never become insulin resistant or diabetic because their bodies keep making new fat cells. Maybe they're just better at storing the fat because their fat cells can get bigger or they can make more fat cells, notes Dr. Samuel. Others run out of storage room sooner, and they start to run into problems when the fat starts to spill over, he explains. When there's no more room at the end, the body stashes the fat wherever it can. It's called ectopic lipid, says Dr. Stanhope. Fat is stored in tissues that are not supposed to be storing it, like the liver, muscle, and the pancreas. Some scientists believe that misplaced fat is the key to insulin resistance. When insulin arrives at a cell, it signals a glucose transporter to ferry blood, sugar, glucose into the cell. Ectopic fat may block the signal, suggest studies at Yale and elsewhere. We think the initial insult is ectopic lipid in muscle or the liver or both, says Dr. Samuel. Excess fat can also lead to low levels of chronic inflammation, which makes matters worse. When cells get over fat, some scientists call them angry fat, because they release inflammatory proteins, explains Sherry Kohlberg, professor of human movement sciences at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. In fact, some researchers contend that it's the inflammatory proteins that keep insulin from working well. Scientists debate whether insulin resistance starts in the liver or in the muscles. But one thing is clear. A fatty liver matters. Researchers at Washington University in St. Louis matched 20 obese people according to high or low levels of liver fat or high or low levels of deep belly visceral fat. Liver fat was a better predictor of metabolic dysfunction than visceral fat. Noted study author Samuel Klein, at the Experimental Biology 2011 meeting in April in Washington, D.C. Another sign that a fatty liver matters, it may explain why a modest drop in weight can get diabetes under control. For example, in 2005, when researchers at Yale put 8 obese people with diabetes on a low-calorie diet for 7 weeks, their fasting blood sugar levels returned to normal. They lost only about 18 pounds, and there was no change in muscle fat content, explains Dr. Samuel. However, 84% of their liver fat disappeared. So, if you cut calories, that will melt away that liver fat, says Dr. Samuel. And once you do that, your liver responds much better to whatever insulin you do make. And it's enough to control your glucose metabolism. How do you know if you have a fatty liver? Well, most people do not get diagnosed, said Dr. Samuel. What gets picked up is when they go to the next step, if they develop inflammation in the liver, steatohepatitis, and that shows up on routine blood tests. You would see that some liver enzymes are elevated. A fatty liver has been in the headlines lately, not so much to explain insulin resistance, but as evidence that too much sugar causes diabetes. Unlike the starch in grains, which consists of long chains of glucose, most sugars, including ordinary table sugar or sucrose, high fructose corn syrup, and honey, are about half glucose and half fructose. It's the fructose half that has recently raised alarms. In animals, or at least laboratory rats and mice, it is clear that if fructose hits the liver in sufficient quantity and with sufficient speed, the liver will convert much of it to fat, writes author Gary Taubes in the New York Times. And this apparently induces a condition known as insulin resistance. If what happens in laboratory rodents also happens in humans, and if we are eating enough sugar to make it happen, then we are in trouble. But so far, at least in humans, it is not clear that fructose causes diabetes. 2 studies have found a higher risk of the disease in people who consumed more fructose or glucose, though surprisingly, not more sucrose, while a third found that there was no link with any sugars. Nor is it clear that fructose causes a fatty liver. It's a reasonable hypothesis, says the University of California's Kimber Stanhope. A fatty liver can happen over the long term as a person gets fatter every year, but it may happen more quickly because fructose is a direct source of liver triglycerides. However, she adds, no direct connection between fructose consumption and fatty liver has been made yet in humans. Researchers have come close, though. In a 2009 study, Dr. Stanhope fed 32 overweight or obese people, mostly aged in their 50s, 25% of the calories as either fructose or glucose-sweetened beverages for 10 weeks each. Now, that's a high dose. Even American adults with the most sugar-laden diets get roughly 30% of their calories from added sugars, which means that about 15% comes from fructose and 15% from glucose. The people in both groups gained about 3 pounds, but the fructose drinkers were much worse off. They gained more visceral fat, and they became more insulin resistant, and their triglycerides went up more after eating, and their livers made more fat, says Dr. Stanhope, and that suggests that we may have had an increase in liver fat. But the researchers did not measure how much fat accumulated in the liver. The technology was just getting developed at the time, so we cannot say for sure. Dr. Stanhope's new study, now underway, is pitting fructose against glucose, high fructose corn syrup, and sucrose. But the liver results will not be ready until the year 2013. So Dr. Stanhope's bottom line is this. There is enough data associating fructose consumption with metabolic diseases like diabetes, heart disease, fatty liver, high blood triglycerides. There's enough evidence associating fructose consumption with those diseases to consume it with caution. And since we get glucose from all our carbohydrates, but fructose only from sugars, the only way to limit fructose is to limit your sugars. And I've had people argue with me right and left that if people overeat, it does not matter what those calories are, says Dr. Stanhope. Our study showed that it does matter. In the Nurses' Health Study, sugar-sweetened beverages were linked to an increased risk of diabetes, says Harvard's Dr. Joanne Manson. And it's not just the nurses. In the year 2010, researchers pulled data from 8 studies on a total of more than 300,000 people to see if diabetes was linked to sugar-sweetened beverages, like soft drinks, fruit drinks, iced tea, energy drinks, vitamin water, you name it. And those who consumed the most sugary drinks, typically 1 or 2 servings a day, had a 26% higher risk of diabetes than those who drank the least. That is, less than 1 serving a month. Why? Well, weight gain is part of the story, notes Dr. Manson. Women who drank more soda were also more likely to gain weight than women who drank less. Liquid calories may not curb your appetite as much as solid calories do, she explains. But sugar-sweetened beverages were linked to a higher risk of diabetes, even when her study compared women who weighed the same. People may get more of a swing in blood sugar when they drink sugar-sweetened beverages, she suggests. But when you eat sugar in solid foods, where that sugar is mixed in with protein and fat, that may slow the absorption. So there's less demand on the pancreas to produce insulin. Magnesium is understudied and underappreciated for its effect on both glucose tolerance and cardiovascular disease, says Dr. Manson. In a study that tracked 85,000 women for 18 years and 42,000 men for 12 years, those who consumed the most magnesium, that is about 375 milligrams a day for women and 450 milligrams a day for men, those who consumed the most from food and supplements combined had a 33% lower risk of diabetes than those who consumed the least magnesium. Another study found lower blood insulin levels and a lower risk of diabetes in women who consumed the most magnesium. It's biologically plausible that magnesium would have an effect on glucose tolerance and insulin sensitivity, notes Dr. Manson. Small studies have already tested magnesium supplements on people who have diabetes. And magnesium supplements have lowered insulin resistance and fasting blood sugar levels in overweight people who do not have diabetes. Larger trials are needed, says Dr. Manson, and we are designing one now. In the meantime, it makes sense to eat magnesium-rich foods like whole grains, leafy greens, beans, nuts, and coffee, rather than to take a supplement. Because taking high doses of magnesium leads to mild diarrhea or other gastrointestinal complaints in some people. Much more research needs to be done, but magnesium is looking very promising, says Dr. Manson. When researchers pooled data from six studies of more than 286,000 participants, they estimated that for every two servings of whole grains that you eat a day, your risk of diabetes drops by 21%. Why is that? Well, whole grains lead to smaller fluctuations in blood sugar and insulin than refined grains and sugars, says Dr. Manson. Whole grains may also lead to a greater sense of fullness. Refined carbohydrates, on the other hand, can lead to hunger and increase food intake due to the wide swings in blood sugar. But, she cautions, people who eat whole grains tend to exercise more, smoke less, and have a healthier dietary pattern. And those things could help account for the link. When researchers examined nine studies on more than 193,000 people, they found that those who drank 4 to 6 cups of regular coffee a day had a 28% lower risk of diabetes than those who drank no more than 2 cups a day. Decaf is also associated with a lower risk of diabetes. So something other than the caffeine in coffee beans appears to be responsible, says Dr. Manson. The mechanism is not yet known. And some studies find a lower risk of diabetes in people who have higher levels of vitamin D, but other studies do not. The research has been very inconsistent, says Dr. Manson. We see totally divergent findings. One possible explanation, the higher your weight, the lower your blood levels of vitamin D. And vitamin D gets sequestered in fat tissue. So anytime you see a correlation with body weight, low levels of vitamin D can appear to be a risk factor if you do not control for body weight, explains Dr. Manson. The VITAL, or vitamin D and omega-3 trial study that Dr. Manson is leading should help clarify vitamin D's role. Roughly 20,000 men aged 60 or older and women aged 65 or older will take vitamin D and or omega-3 fats, or a placebo for 5 years. The goal of this trial is to see if either supplement affects the risk of cancer, heart disease, diabetes, memory loss, or other health problems. We also saw a slight increased risk of diabetes with fish and omega-3s in the nurses' health study, says Dr. Manson. But other studies show a lower risk. And it's not just her studies. At least as many studies suggest benefits as harm. The evidence is so inconsistent and difficult to understand. And it's not clear why some studies find that fish eaters have a slightly higher risk. Among the possibilities, fish may have high levels of pollutants and dioxin. But the good news is, we are doing a trial to look at glucose tolerance, says Dr. Manson. And this study will piggyback on the vital trial. So what's your risk of diabetes? The only way to find out is to get your blood sugar tested at least every 3 years, starting at the age of 45. Your risk for diabetes is higher if you are 45 years of age or older, if you're overweight, if you are African American, Hispanic, Latino American, Asian American, Pacific Islander, or American Indian. Your risk is higher if you have a parent, brother, or sister with diabetes. Or if you have high blood pressure, that is, above 140 over 90. Or if you have low LDL cholesterol, less than 40 for men and less than 50 for women. Your risk for diabetes is also higher if you have high triglycerides, that is 250 or more. If you had diabetes when pregnant or gave birth to a large baby, that is over 9 pounds. Or if you are active fewer than 3 times a week. So, what's the bottom line? The best way to dodge diabetes is to lose or not to gain extra pounds. To limit sweets, especially sugar-sweetened drinks. Even the naturally occurring sugars in 100% fruit juice may raise your risk. By eating leafy greens, whole grains, beans, and nuts to boost your magnesium levels. Another good way to dodge diabetes is to get the recommended daily allowance for vitamin D from supplements or foods fortified with vitamin D. You can also dodge the risk of diabetes by doing at least 30 minutes of brisk walking or other aerobic exercise every day and shooting for 2 or 3 strength training sessions a week. Each session should include 8 to 12 repetitions of 8 to 10 exercises. Well, folks, we've reached the conclusion of this month's segment of Nutrition News. The show will be rebroadcast this week on Friday at 11 p.m. and on Saturday at 3 p.m. Please join me for the next edition of Nutrition News, which will air on Wednesday, August 3rd. I'm Ann Weller, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and I hope that you've enjoyed the show. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience, and it is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next month.